It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
The WHO calls the Ebola outbreak the most severe health emergency of modern times. The WHO's Margaret Chan warns the world is ill-prepared for such a public health crisis. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The head of the World Health Organization Monday warned the Ebola outbreak is, quote, the most severe acute health emergency seen in modern times. Dr. Margaret Chan also said the virus poses a threat to the governments and societies of West Africa. She said the number of cases is rising exponentially in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Said the outbreak shows how the world is ill-prepared for a severe and sustained public health emergency. The illness has claimed the lives of more than 4,000 people in West Africa since March. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization is appealing for funds to raise awareness of the disease. The FAO's Dominique Bourgeon, speaking in Rome Monday, said Ebola is also affecting food security.
In that respect, FAO, since the very beginning of the crisis, has been engaged essentially on two fronts. On the first hand, we are engaged on the health front, and we are part of our program. The program we are proposing now is about raising awareness on the disease.
The FAO is asking for $30 million to deal with food security threats and to raise awareness. One UN official said up to 40% of farms have been abandoned in Sierra Leone with food shortages in Senegal as Ebola disrupts regional trade. In Washington, President Obama Monday met with his national security team and spoke with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and French President François Hollande on ways the international community can step up efforts to, quote, decisively address the Ebola crisis. This is VOA News. Meanwhile, the head of the new UN mission on Ebola emergency response, Anthony Banbury, said progress is being made to fight the outbreak in West Africa, but cautioned that U.S. and British military personnel deployed to the region may miss their goal of deploying all materials to construct new treatment centers and providing logistical support within 30 days. In Liberia Monday, most healthcare workers reported for work, ignoring calls for a strike over working conditions and pay. Liberia's Health Workers Association has demanded workers get extra hazard pay for potentially exposing themselves to the Ebola virus. In an interview with VOA, Liberia's assistant health minister, Tolbert Nienswa, said the government can't meet all workers' demands because it needs to keep opening Ebola treatment centers.
We understand that their leadership have understood this. Mm-hmm. We have to put all of our differences aside, mm-hmm. unite, come together as a country, mm-hmm. solve this problem, and then we can continue to discuss mm-hmm. those issues.
Liberia has been the hardest hit country with Ebola, killing more than 2,300 since March, including some 95 health workers. Health authorities in the U.S. are advising the nation's hospitals to reevaluate their approach to providing care to Ebola patients following the first transmission of the virus within the country. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Tom Frieden urged hospitals to watch for patients with fever or symptoms of Ebola returning from West Africa.
We'll work with hospitals throughout the country to think Ebola in someone with a fever or other symptoms who has had travel to any of the three affected countries in the previous 21 days.
Dr. Frieden said authorities are investigating how a nurse in Dallas, Texas, became the first person to contract the illness within the U.S. He said an unknown breach of protocol is suspected for the infection of the woman who treated a Liberian man who was the first person to die of Ebola in the United States. The CDC is now monitoring nearly 50 hospital workers who treated or were in contact with Thomas Eric Duncan, who died last week in Dallas. Madagascar's former president has been arrested hours after returning to the country following more than 5 years in exile. Reports say Marc Ravalomanana was detained by government forces at his home in the capital, Antananarivo. Earlier, he spoke to supporters outside the home, saying he had come back to work for Madagascar's development. A Sudanese opposition party has decided to boycott next April's scheduled presidential election, the Popular Congress Party said Monday. A lack of democracy will not allow for a fair vote. The opposition has accused the government of President Omar al-Bashir, which has ruled the country since a military coup in 1989, of jailing dissidents, censoring the media, and closing newspapers. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ebola fears mount in the United States after a nurse who cared for Liberia Ebola patient Thomas Eric Duncan has tested positive for the disease.
The American people are rightfully concerned. They are concerned because the Ebola virus is an unseen threat and is only a plane flight away from our shores.
That's Republican Congressman Michael McCaul of Texas. The British government is criticized over its Ebola policy. African immigrants say they are being targeted by Greek police. Former Boko Haram captives from Cameroon recount their ordeal. And this morning, we remember the late Pan-Africanist Professor Ali Mazuri.
He was really a preeminent intellectual of great innovative thinking. He used biography and juxtaposition idea to explain African in a way which no one could have done it.
That's Ugandan-born Ami Omara Utunu, professor of history and international human rights at the University of Connecticut. And Uganda's government takes mineral ownership from land owners. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. America's top disease control official says the first known transmission of Ebola in the United States dictates a rethinking and a redoubling of protocols to protect healthcare workers and the public from the deadly virus. A nurse in Dallas, Texas, has tested positive for Ebola after caring for Liberian Ebola patient Thomas Eric Duncan, who died last week. VOA's Michael Bowman reports the new case prompted President Barack Obama to adjust his schedule in order to receive an update from senior officials on Ebola containment efforts.
Concern about the new Ebola case extended to the White House, where President Obama invited cameras into a hastily arranged briefing on improving the U.S. health system's preparedness. Earlier, hazardous materials workers cleaned out the apartment of the infected Dallas nurse, who is now identified by family members as 26-year-old Nina Pham. The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Thomas Frieden, addressed an increasingly alarmed American public.
Stopping Ebola is hard. We have to rethink the way we address Ebola infection control, because even a single infection is unacceptable.
Precisely how the nurse became infected is unknown, whether through human error or a failure of protective gear or hospital protocols. Frieden said he cannot rule out the possibility of additional cases being detected and announced an extensive urgent campaign to alert and safeguard the nation's medical staff in hopes of preventing further transmission of Ebola.
People on the front lines are really protecting all of us. The enemy here is a virus, Ebola. It's not a person, it's not a country, it's not a place, it's not a hospital, it's a virus. And it's a virus that's tough to fight. But together, I'm confident that we will stop it.
Several U.S. airports are strengthening health screening procedures for passengers arriving from three West African nations. That may not be enough, according to Republican Congressman Michael McCaul, who does not rule out temporarily halting U.S. visas granted in parts of Africa.
And the American people are rightfully concerned. They are concerned because the Ebola virus is an unseen threat and is only a plane flight away from our shores.
Mounting fears extend beyond countries that have registered Ebola cases. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is a global epidemic. We are cooperating with other countries in addition to preserving our borders.
But panic is unwarranted and unhelpful, according to Dr. Ian Smith of the World Health Organization.
Fear of infection has spread around the world much faster than the virus.
Amid mounting anxieties, some possible good news. Russian health officials say they have developed vaccines against Ebola that are ready for testing. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
With a large West African diaspora population and tens of thousands of travelers passing through its airports every day, Health professionals say it is highly likely that Britain will soon see cases of Ebola, but there's been criticism of the British government's response to the crisis, with policy U-turns and conflicting advice. Henry Richwell reports from London.
British authorities staged an 8-hour nationwide drill Saturday to simulate an Ebola case arriving in the country, designed to test the health system and the government response. Britain's Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt announced in Parliament Monday that screenings would be introduced for passengers arriving from the worst-hit countries of Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea.
This will allow potential Ebola virus carriers arriving in the UK to be identified, tracked and given rapid access to expert health advice should they develop symptoms.
Some medical experts dispute the effectiveness of screening. Professor Tom Solomon is director of the Institute of Infection and Global Health at the University of Liverpool.
This is a disease which has an incubation period up to 21 days. So if people have symptoms when they leave a country in West Africa, that will be picked up. And there's very little to be gained additionally from screening people again 10 hours later when they arrive in the UK.
Britain said last week it would not introduce screening, but then reverse the policy. Sophie Harman of Queen Mary University of London described the government response as reactionary and haphazard.
If a case of Ebola does come to the UK, and increasingly we think that is going to happen, we do have a robust health system to deal with this issue. And I think that was an important message that the government has slightly lost by introducing these kind of border restrictions, which are quite facile at best.
Dr. Stephen Meppham of Royal Free Hospital in London, which houses the country's only high-level isolation unit, says there is no need for the British public to worry.
Britain is a very different environment to West Africa, and it's inconceivable to think that the virus could travel in the same way as it has in healthcare settings in West Africa.
Workers for Britain's National Health Service staged a 4-hour strike Monday over pay. Christina McCannia of Unison, the public workers' union, says government cuts could undermine the airport screening programme.
Due to cuts in NHS funding, that the staff, the health staff who work at airports are actually being cut, and it's our understanding that almost three quarters of them have been cut at Heathrow.
The government insists the country is well prepared. Health professionals say it is very likely the disease will soon arrive in Britain. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Kenyan-born Professor Ali Manzuri, who passed away at age 81, is being remembered as a pan-Africanist and an innovative thinker who put Africa on the world map by popularizing African ideals. Ugandan-born Amin Omara Utunu is professor of history and international human rights at the University of Connecticut. He says Manzuri lived life as the great pan-Africanist Kwame Nkrumah would have wanted us to live.
He was an immense, great intellectual, innovative thinker. He put Africa on a world map in terms of popularizing African ideas. And his commitment, especially after the 1986 Africa a Triple Heritage documentary he made, was so powerful in actually demonstrating his commitment to Africa. But above all, he really was a popularizer of ideas. The tragedy for me as an African is that he never served within Africa. He was very good at highlighting and analyzing the ills within African society, but he never quite touched Kenya, for very understandable reason, perhaps because he feared that the repercussions would be enormous.
The same thing now for some African intellectuals today and journalists. Many of them, like Manzuri, are forced to live in exile.
That is the greatest tragedy because our best minds, arguably, are always outside the continent. Yet if we had a continent where people could earn their living decently, honestly, if there was freedom for everyone, if in fact there was democracy within Africa, I think most of our brilliant minds would be within the continent because they love the continent. I know Ali Manzuri loved the continent very, very much indeed. But for all of us who aspire to intellectual greatness, I think what he gave us was simply this. The intellectual must be independent-minded, must be innovative, must not be very protective, And I think it was never predictable at all. The context in which he should be understood that he was really a preeminent intellectual of great innovative thinking. He used biography and juxtaposition ideas to explain Africa in a way which no one could have done it. And whenever he spoke, he captured the audience, and everyone paid attention to him.
Dr. Manzuri also wrote about Islam and globalization and counterterrorism. I wonder what he will say about the rise of Al-Shabaab in Somalia and now Boko Haram in Nigeria. Those are things I think he was talking about.
I'm sure Professor Manzuri would have seen this as a perversion of Islam, because Islam is really about peace, about love, about light. And he demonstrated in his teaching, in his writings, that you could still be a Muslim and be as intellectual, be as liberal as possible. His ideas will live forever because he wrote so many books. Whether one liked his idea or not, he was a great, great thinker. And so I think Africa has lost a great, great intellectual, a giant. He belongs to Africa's intellectual hall of fame.
That was Ugandan-born Ami Omara Otunu, professor of history and international human rights at the University of Connecticut. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 14th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. Cameroon government officials and officials from the Chinese embassy in Cameroon say 27 hostages from Cameroon, including 10 Chinese workers freed by suspected Boko Haram militants, have now spent 2 days with their families after several months in captivity. Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited the hostages and reports on their experiences while in the hands of the militants and how they were received back home in Yaoundé.
Crowds of people turned out at Kolofata in northern Cameroon when word came that their leader, cleric and mayor, Seni Buka, along with the wife of Cameroon's Vice Prime Minister, Amadou Ali, and 15 others kidnapped from the village had been freed. The cleric's brother, Amidou Buka, told VOA that life was at a standstill in Kolofata since the 17 were taken by Boko Haram fighters.
Comme le lamido est libre, nous savons qu'il va essayer de nous gérer un peu la situation ici. Par exemple, celui de notre scolarité.
He says now that their leader is free, he is sure that children will go back to school and that teachers will teach. Kolofata resident Abba Suleimanu says he is very thankful to God for bringing back all the 27 people safe after nearly 3 months in captivity. He says all of the village residents were praying for the release of their cleric and all of the hostages, and that they are grateful to Cameroon President Paul Biya, who negotiated their release. The villagers were captured during two July 27 attacks around Kolofata that left 15 dead. Released hostage Abdurrahman Seni, who survived a gunshot to his hand, told VOA he and the other captives were forced to eat whatever was provided and at times went for days without water to drink.
La vie c'est un enfer. Je vois les gens qui marchent avec l'arme et l'arme blanche de gauche à droite.
He says they lived in miserable conditions and that they were tortured by men armed with knives and guns. Abdurrahman Seni adds that he did not see any of the more than 200 girls from the Nigerian town of Chibok that Boko Haram claimed responsibility for kidnapping in April.
On met les hommes à part et les femmes à part. On ne donne pas l'eau à boire et l'eau.
He says women are separated from men in the various detention camps run by the militants in the bush. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Greece is the main entry and transit point for African, Asian, and Middle Eastern immigrants desperate to get to Europe in search of protection and a better life. The Greek government is under pressure from the European Union to stem the influx. 2 years ago, the authorities began an operation of detaining immigrants and asylum seekers, some of whom say they are targeted indiscriminately despite having papers to work and live in the country. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Athens.
In a small shop in the Cape Salie neighborhood, a group of African immigrants has met for a chat. They converse in a low tone, worried of their surroundings. The shop owner, Chuks Ibe, tells VOA he has been in Greece for 20 years without papers, and most of his customers are Africans.
They don't accept you as a black man. Even my shop here, it's once in a while you can see a Greek person. I was being patronized by foreigners. African brothers. But the Greeks, before they come, maybe it's late night, they're desperate in need of it, they will come to you. But that's for that. Some will put hands, this is a black man, they leave.
The father of five also says the Greek government does not recognize his children as Greek citizens.
The children they're born here, they don't care about them. They don't give them money. They don't give them citizenship.
No paper.
It's a problem. Like my children, I have five children here. They're here, but they see them as a foreigner.
Daniel Ikuchuku has lived in Greece for 13 years. Every 6 months he has to pay 600 euros to renew his residential and work permit. But Ikuchuku says he cannot work now because the last time he went to renew his permit, he was told to come back after 6 months.
The woman I meet there, I tell her, see how many years I'm staying in Greece with this paper, and I paid everything. I paid my tax. I was working in airport, international airport here. Yeah. I'm a good worker. You people stop me work. I'm paying tax. My company paying 350, 250, depend what I make in a month.
Another immigrant, Emeka, says he has documents that allow him to stay in the country, but frequently he is stopped by police.
Imagine a policeman can ask you in this country to lie down on the floor, on the road. You will have paper and nothing. Even if you show him the paper, he will still ask you to go down on the floor.
That was Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Athens. In Uganda, the mineral sector is beginning to boom, and along with it, contentious issues about land value and fair resettlement packages. Some are warning that these rifts could cause instability. However, the government says it is offering fair reimbursement. Lisbeth Pollard has more from Kampala.
In early October, Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni let out a bombshell. He announced that his cabinet would push to amend the Mineral Act of 2011, instituting the government as the legitimate landowner of mineral-rich land. Currently, Section 42 of that act states that all exploration companies must obtain surface rights from landowners before any mineral license is granted. Mr. Museveni wants that changed so investors deal with the government instead of those with land titles. Although the government sometimes intervenes when disputes become litigious, this would change the ownership system all over Uganda. Don Bwesigyi Binyina, the executive director of the Africa Center for Energy and Mineral Policy, describes how poor governmental planning could result in major conflicts.
You need to engage the communities. You need to sensitize them about what you're doing, about what mineral resource development is all about their own benefits. Where do they benefit as a community? Are they getting jobs? What trickle-down effect are you having from the industry? It's not possible for the government to compulsorily acquire this land because, let's face it, most wars internationally have been fought over land. You're talking of communally owned land, which these communities have owned for generations and generations.
The revisions to the law are already in the works and could be introduced as early as December. Those inside the Ministry of Energy and Mineral Development think that just because the government owns the minerals, people will still be treated fairly and there's no reason for disputes to escalate. John Kennedy Okiwing, a mining engineer with the ministry, explains.
People don't understand that how can they own the land and then the minerals are not theirs. Yeah, that is a very contagious issue when it comes to mining. And in most cases, they have always reached an agreement. You know, always the developers have complained that either the landowners are overcharging them or they don't consider them as people who are coming to develop. So in that case, what I feel, the president was trying to raise up is that he's going to put up something to help the developers access land which has minerals. So if you are the landowner, maybe government will do something for you, maybe to just make the process a light one for the developers.
The government says provisions in all its corporate leases require companies to employ and train Ugandans, meaning that communities could benefit from the mineral industry. However, oversight of the companies is limited, and analysts say more provisions must be created to ensure fair land resettlement in the future. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Morocco remains the venue for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, reiterated in Cairo, Egypt on Monday. CAF is responding to a request by the Morocco Youth and Sports Ministry that the tournament scheduled from the 17th January to the 8th of February next year be postponed owing to the Ebola virus disease currently ravaging the Mano River region in West Africa. CAF points out that they have taken necessary precautions in the ongoing Nations Cup qualifiers based on the expert advice from the World Health Organization. The CAF Executive Committee is to discuss Morocco's request at their meeting in the Algerian capital Algiers on the 2nd of November before engaging the Moroccan authorities the following day in Rabat. Meanwhile, Morocco beat Kenya 3-0 in a friendly match played in Marrakech on Monday. Earlier on, Tanzania dismissed Benin 4-1 in Dar es Salaam. In Namibia, after a day's rest, Zambia challenged Nigeria before Namibia encounter Ivory Coast at the Telecom Namibia Mobile African Women's Championships at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in Katutura Township, Windhoek, today, Tuesday. In rugby news, South Africa placed fourth overall after their 19-0 loss to England at the IRB Sevens tournament in Gold Coast, Australia on Sunday. Canada dismissed Kenya 40-7 in the final of the Shield contest. Turning to athletics, Kenya's Joyce Chepkurui and Emily Chebet were locked in a photo finish in the women's 10 kilometers at the ASICS Grand 10 kilometers in Berlin, Germany on Sunday. Although both athletes were credited with an identical time of 31 minutes and 2 seconds, Chepkurui was crowned the winner. In the men's race, Ethiopian Kinde Atenau triumphed in 27 minutes and 49 seconds. Elsewhere, Ethiopian Tilahun Regasa clocked 2 hours 6 minutes and 21 seconds to win the Eindhoven Marathon in the Netherlands on Sunday, while his compatriot Mukhtar Edris was timed 28 minutes and 52 seconds when he prevailed at the Giro International di Trento 10-kilometer run in northern Italy on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omen, Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The head of the World Health Organization says Ebola poses a threat to the governments and societies of West Africa. Dr. Margaret Chan, Director General of the WHO, said Monday that she has never seen an infectious disease contribute so strongly to potential state failure. In a statement to Health Conference in the Philippines, Chan warned that the number of cases is rising exponentially in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Meanwhile, health authorities in the United States are advising the nation's hospitals to reevaluate their approach to providing care to Ebola patients following the first transmission of the virus within this country. And that's it for this Tuesday, October 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Barty saying, have a lovely and nice day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta appears before the International Criminal Court on charges of crime against humanity for allegedly helping to organize Kenya's post-election violence in 2007 and 2008. Mr. Kenyatta is the first sitting leader to appear at the Hague Tribunal. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.